is rabbinic ethics on the assumption that rabbis are rather like other people, or more or less like other people? So I want to begin by reading a quote from Barchester Towers by Anthony Trollope, which it's free on Kindle. That's how I discovered it this year on a long airplane trip. So here's what he says. If we look to our clergymen to be more than men, we shall probably teach ourselves to think that they are less, and can hardly hope to raise the character of the pastor by denying to him the right to entertain the aspirations of a man. I'll read it again so it can sink in. Right? If we look to our clergymen to be more than men, we shall probably teach ourselves to think that they are less, and we can hardly hope to raise the character of the pastor by denying to him the right to entertain the aspirations of a man. Our archdeacon was worldly. Who among us is not so? He was ambitious. Who among us is ashamed to own that, quote, last infirmity of noble minds? And he goes on, right? This is the book is largely about the character of various clergy persons in this fictional town in England. And the underlying thesis is that clergymen are human beings, and they have all the drives and weaknesses and strengths of human beings, each to their own. And so what you have to do is try and figure out how each human being can flourish ethically in the positions in which they are placed, as opposed to assuming that people are placed in particular positions. Either they're placed in those positions because of character, or they grow into those positions because of character. So I want to set out on the premise that that rabbis do not have any particular magic, right, or different ethical powers, either because of their position or because of their training. And the challenge is to figure out how to take human beings who are put into that position and enable them to be better human beings in that position.
And now, should we say by inference for the religious person also?
Yeah, I don't think. Right, I don't think. I think we're actually out of copies left to share. Although people have, right. So I think the challenge. Right. So the challenge of constructing something resembling like rabbinic ethics is not to assume that rabbis are different. Now, there is Gemaras say that tzaddikim to some extent are different than the rest of us, and tzaddikim have stronger evil inclinations. The greater the tzaddik, the greater the evil inclination. But rabbis are not tzaddikim. Talmidei chachamim are not tzaddikim, per se. There are many tzaddikim who are neither, and there are many who are both who are not tzaddikim. So I think that it's fair to assume that rabbis, like everyone else, are beinonim. Right? They're average people who have average strengths and weaknesses. And the question then is to figure out what are the specific challenges of their positions. And how is it useful to construct an ethic for them? Now, there are two ways to approach this question. One way is to approach the question directively, which is to say, look, these are the things that rabbis should do. And we're just going to draw up a code as these are the things that rabbis should do. So I asked my wife yesterday what she thought should be the first beginning of a rabbinic code of ethics. And it's pretty much the way everyone began in the conversations online. The first thing about rabbinic code of ethics is self-care. Okay, people should take care of themselves. Didn't convince me. that's really, the thesis is that people who don't take care of themselves inevitably end up abusing others. I don't know. There might have been some agenda behind that answer. So I'm not really going to start there. But I should point out that that is certainly an issue, and that in certain kinds of positions, that is certainly the case. The second question is pedagogic. How would you teach rabbis to be better? And that's really what I want to do tonight. What I want to do mostly is read an extended text with you. I should give the credit to Rabbi Joshua Yoder. Some 3 years ago or so, put together a syllabus for a rabbinic ethics curriculum. And in the aftermath of certain scandals this year, he republished on his blog a link to that curriculum. And I put out a Dvar Torah in which I challenged the whole notion of a rabbinic ethics curriculum through text on the grounds that what rabbis are good at is manipulating texts. So the notion that you would train people, the same way the Gemara says over and over again, in lots of different ways, that Torah can be an elixir of life or a potion of death or whatever, however you want to translate this. It's sam both ways, but it doesn't work in English. I don't think elixir of death works well. Or potion of life, neither of those work well. So we'll say elixir of life and potion of death. So there's no guarantee anywhere in halacha that learning Torah per se works to improve character. It works to intensify character as opposed to improve character. So if we teach rabbis more Torah, there's no guarantee per se that it will make rabbis better. So I set out in my Dvar Torah to try and take one of the texts Rabbi Yehuda had said and show how I could in fact twist this into all sorts of things that might or might not be helpful. And that's really what I plan to do with you tonight, is I want to learn that text with you and see what you think that text is saying. Right? Suppose we learned it right. Right? If you were trying to plan to have a teacher who's much more directive than me teaching the course, so they're going to use this text as a way to teach rabbinic ethics, and it does seem to be to some degree about that. So how would you teach this text? What do you think are the lessons that we're supposed to derive from this text about behavior? But I want to put in a programmatic challenge first, and that's one that I hope will not so much be in conversation tonight, although it may be in terms of the questions, but it's a question that I think that we need to raise in the community as a whole, which is to try and, right, in order to have rabbinic ethics, we have to define the term rabbi. And we have to recognize, right, because if I'm right, that rabbis are pretty much like other people, so what raises the challenges of rabbinic ethics are the particular positions they are placed in. And we have to acknowledge that the positions in which rabbis are placed nowadays are probably very dissimilar to the types of positions that rabbis have been placed in historically. And so models for what rabbinic ethics, what halakha would have been 100 years ago may not at all be the kinds of challenges that are being faced by rabbis nowadays. So, for example, if you define a rabbi as somebody who is regularly engaged in intense private pastoral conversation, so where will you find evidence of that in the Talmud?
Wherever you want
it to be. Right, that's all right. There isn't so much about that. If you want to define rabbinic ethics around what the rabbis say in their sermon, right? So that's a wholly modern phenomenon, and those are just symptoms. Right? The question is, what is the relationship of rabbi as a class of person to other people in terms of their ethics, right? So the question is the position best defined by relationship to rabbis of the past? We spent this morning in the Beit Midrash talking about a tshuva of Moshe, which seemed to be in a wholly different world in terms of what a rabbi was to many of the fellows, where Rav Moshe sort of seems to assume that a rabbi who owns a building in which people daven is the owner of the shul, and if you start another shul, you are taking away that rabbi's livelihood. And the particular rabbi in question apparently occasionally insulted his congregants and called them communists and things like that. And Rav Moshe says, okay, you know, it's not nice, but it's not a really big deal. That doesn't justify you in davening somewhere else. Right? And that's a wholly different conception. Right? So I argued that the right way to think about it, and this goes back to a lecture that Dr. Adam Furziger gave here under the same CMTL umbrella some years ago, in which he said that we judge the Rabbanut in Israel unfairly because we think of the Rabbanut in light of synagogue rabbis here, and synagogue rabbis have a maximum of 400 families maybe, and usually they have assistants for that, but right, rabbis in Israel can have a constituency of 25, 30,000, and fundamentally their role is that of the registry of motor vehicles, not the role of a pastor. They're not supposed to know their parishioners. They're supposed to be able to provide paperwork for marriage and divorce and burial, and they're supposed to provide adequate educational opportunities for people to provide to educate themselves on the things they need to do. And it's just I'm missing the word. You're comparing incommensurates. That's not the right word I'm thinking. Right? But it's misaligned if you think if you're expecting rabbis as I told the students this morning, right, imagine, right, that the experience of getting a license is among the most powerful experiences in teenagerhood. And when I taught at Gann Academy, so one of the big ceremonies of the year is the getting of a license ceremony, which includes the presentation of a Jewish book and the recitation of Tfilah Derech. Right? Now, we can imagine that that's what the Registry of Motor Vehicles should be. Right? Our goal is the process of becoming a driver is part of the process of becoming an adult. We want this to be a warm feeling in which everyone emerges with a deeper sense of responsibility and attachment to the government that makes it possible. Right? So everyone in the Registry of Motor Vehicle will be friendly. Right? And talk about, right, we'll talk about ways to personalize the experience. Right? Ways in which you can do reading of, you know, you can watch great films of great drivers or great drivers of the past and talk about how I wish to be like so-and-so or I wish to be like so-and-so. You can give a lecture about, you know, ethics of driving in the past and all sorts of things and today, right, which happens, some of which happens again. But that's not what we think the Registry of Motor Vehicles is. That would be beautiful. And possibly it would improve Israeli society tremendously if we decided to focus Kirov operations in the Registry of Motor Vehicles as opposed to in the Rabbanut. We should consider that. But I want to point out that we really need to think about what it is, right? What the social expectations, right? What the social positioning of rabbis is? What we mean by rabbis? Do we mean synagogue rabbis? Do we mean anyone who teaches Torah in public? Do we mean anyone who is looked upon as having, right? As having scholarship? Do we mean anyone who holds a particular title? And also, right? All sorts of things like that. And it seems to me that since that position has been in radical flux for quite some time, especially in some ways in the Orthodox community, that we might not quite be ready to really think about what rabbinic ethics means. Okay, so what I want to do, that's really the conversation I'm hoping will last for the next 20 or 30 years. I want to read a text with you. And then I'm hoping that as we read this text together, and I apologize that owing to a not perfect storm, but a highly serious storm of things, I didn't end up being able to print out the translation, much of which I had completed. So I want to read the text with you line by line. That starts with the page that is listed on Chulin Membet Amud Aleph, and I'll carry you through. If you're not reading the Hebrew with me, I'll read it line by line. And then we'll stop after each section and say, so what do you think? Right, is this a good standard? Is this, right, to which, what kind of, right, to which rabbis should be held? What are the downsides of it? But actually, you know what, before I do that, I want to tell a story, which is, in terms of rabbinic honor, I think this is probably the story that, I think it's useful to have, like, an image that concentrates your mind. So this is something that I have thought about for years and years and years. I would guess, thinking back on it now, it's probably about 30 years that I've been thinking about this story. Must be 30 years. Where I was working in a camp, and the camp had a learning director, and here's what a learning director did. And I thought about for 30 years whether it was the right thing or not the right thing. When he came to a group of, right, to whether we had regular learning groups, an hour and a half a day, 2 hours a day, whatever it was, and he would walk around from group to group to see how we were doing. And as he walked over to the group, he would say, "Stand up, boys." And everyone would stand up, and he would say, "You can sit down." Everyone would sit down. And I always wondered, right, was that good education, or was that self-serving?
He was wanting you to stand up to show you stand up for a rabbi?
Yes, right. That was right. He was trying to inculcate Kvod HaRav, Kvod HaTorah. So stand up, boys. Now, part of the ambivalence about it is you would think that after the first or second time, everyone would get it right. But no. He would still have to, right, you know, by the end of the summer, he would still stand up, boys. So it didn't work in that sense. On the other hand, what he did to try and make sure that nobody would think it was personal, I think that was, right, he was also the staff member, I think every camp has one, who danced on a table at Shalosh Sudot. So you would see that it wasn't all, you know, it wasn't about his maintaining his artificial dignity, that he was willing to do that. But I was, you know, so that always just struck me. You know, what does it do to be in a position that you demand the kavod? I wonder if you forgive it. Do you feel like you're not being responsible to kvod haTorah? Right, here you are. You represent Torah in this camp, and people aren't standing up. On the other hand, it does really bad things to you to walk into a room and think that people are supposed to stand up. And that, I think, sort of embodies what I think in various iterations of rabbinic rule, the problem is, as it is in many positions, that you're stuck being, you know, that what is necessary for your position is not necessarily good for you, for your own soul. And that's part of the challenge in constructing rabbinic ethics, is that you're not just responsible for your own development, you're also a symbol that that stands for everything else. Okay, so now I will take two questions. Ellie and Elliot, yes?
Just to respond to your question, can you teach ethics to rabbis? Can you teach ethics to people in general?
Right, that's a fair question. It's the same question as any notion of whether professional ethics courses work and what it means to teach ethics. Right, teaching ethics is not teaching geometry. So that's a whole challenge, which, you know, the whole notion of values-based education in schools, does it work? And you know, I suppose if it's not possible, then a lot of my life doesn't seem so meaningful. And on the other hand, it's really hard to do. Right, it's really hard to do. And I think one of the first things to realize is, you know, is that you're not going to succeed all the time. And the notion that there's a perfect mode of way of teaching ethics is really hard. And particularly if you want to teach ethics in a way that preserves other people's autonomy. And I think that makes it harder.
I mean, as a person who received a lifetime of ethics-based education in yeshiva,
yeah.
I know that I have classmates who act unethically.
Right, so it doesn't always work. The question is, does it work slightly better on average, right? Maybe all you're going is for a slightly marginal improvement. I don't know. I think that's a fair challenge. Do we really expect rabbis on, right, is it part of the notion of rabbinic ethics that rabbis should be more ethical as rabbis than plumbers are as plumbers? Right, is that an aspiration? So I tell my wife frequently, because she gets right, that what percentage of plumbers do you expect to be competent? Or car mechanics? Okay, that's about the percentage of rabbis you should expect to be competent.
How many surgeons do you expect to be competent?
Ah, so that's interesting. We expect surgeons to be more competent on the whole.
In fact, you have another person. If rabbis had a better effect on their life as a plumber, then we wouldn't care as much about them being...
How many therapists do you expect to be competent?
Yeah, that's fair.
Right, so my percentage isn't so high, really.
Yeah, but the free market causes more people to...
Because it's harder. It's harder to tell. But that may be my cynicism. I think we hit minimal competence in some fields more. And the truth is, I don't necessarily want to know what percentage of surgeons are competent.
I think John Venner made a very good point, which is, what industry do we pay a salary equivalent to that of rabbis? And then what is the expected competence in that industry?
Or it might be, you know, of any other academic fields.
No.
No?
No.
Okay, good. It's an economics conversation. Elliot, what do you want to say?
I just want to say, with the question about how we view rabbis today versus in the past, I think the last point, I think, is the most important, right? No matter what the job is, we still see rabbis today, maybe as people representing Torah. And so the question is, as people representing Torah, do they have this, should they have this extra ethical responsibility, which I think the answer is yes. And then the question is, can the text talk about that extra ethical responsibility you have when you're representing Torah?
Okay, well, we should talk about, it may go both ways, right? Now, if you have an obligation to make people stand up when you walk into the room, which is normally against your conception of what people should behave, right? Normally you should be modest and retiring. So we have to be careful, right? The extra responsibilities are not necessarily ethical.
Okay.
Right, and I think that's a really important part, because I think that a lot of the challenges will revolve around that kind of tension, that the things you're supposed to do, right, if you're just supposed to model ethical behavior, that's great. But you're not necessarily just supposed to model ethical behavior. Right? You know, I mean, you're supposed to get people to stand, right, to accept certain kinds of symbols, and that's a real challenge. Okay, Harvey, but that's the only comment I can take right now that I'm going to go on. Yes?
Two comments. First of all, there seems to be a little conflating here with between ethics and competence. To go back to the medical analogy,
yeah.
You can be an incompetent doctor and be very ethical.
Sure.
And also, I just wanted to, as a person who's been working for a long time, I periodically have to take ethical training at work, which essentially has devolved into, you know, these are the things that you shouldn't do because it will get the company in trouble or will get you in trouble. And I think that courses in the ethics and professional fields often are probably going to end up at that level.
Yeah, so when I wrote, I said I didn't think Rabbi Yehuda's course approach was necessarily going to work, and probably the first thing we need to do is just put out a clear code of conduct, which is not the same thing as ethics. It's just a code of conduct which details whether your employer can be sued or not, or you can be sued, and we just have, you know, have straightforward carrots and sticks. But I want to try and do something a little bit more sophisticated tonight. Okay, hold the questions now. I want to actually read a text. I think, you know, rabbinic ethics should involve teaching Torah instead of getting up and expressing your own opinions all the time. Okay, so the Mishnah says that the Mishnah has a list of animals that become trefot, which include punctures of the esophagus and breaks in the trachea. What a trefot, right? A trefot, just for the background, a trefot is an animal that halachically is deemed to be sort of a zombie. And zombie, right? Zombie animals are not kosher. It's not quite dead. It's mostly dead. The easiest way of defining it, now this is a category that exists by both animals and human beings, but not quite the same way. By animals, it is defined as an animal having a puncture or wound in a vital organ that will kill it within a year. It's defined the same way by human beings. The problem by animals is that the list doesn't work empirically. That animals have all these sorts of punctures and don't die. This was very distressing in the Middle Ages when people discovered these animals weren't dying. It's very, very zombie cows. It's very distressing. Right now, all our cows are zombies. That's a big deal, right? Because our milk cows are fed too much, and their stomachs are going to explode with methane, so you have to puncture them. That's a major kashrus issue. But be that as it may, by human beings we tend to paskin realistically. If it doesn't kill you within a year, you weren't really a trefa. By animals, you're a trefa if you have these punctures regardless, and that's what those are all the things we do to investigate. What we call glatt kosher, right? Is a way of investigating whether the animal's lungs have right, glatt is smooth, and so you investigate the animal's lungs to see if it has a lesion that might cover up a puncture. Okay, so Gemara wants to know how you measure the break in the trachea. And it records a dispute between Rav, who says Rav Uvia, and some other people who say Rav Chalala. And then we have a story. The story is Hay Psuka Grogeres da Asoy Lakame de Rav. So this animal with a severed trachea came in front of Rav. Probably it was brought in front of Rav instead of walking itself. That would have been its own problem. The animal with the punctured trachea came in front of Rav. And Rav began investigating it according to the position Rav Uvia. And Rav, no, it doesn't matter. Variable, right? Method X, method A as opposed to method B. Rav used method A, and Rav Kana Ravasi said to him, you told us that the proper method is method B. So he sent it to Rabbi Bar Bar Chana. Rabbi Bar Bar Chana used method B and declared it kosher. Okay, so far we're fine. But then it says, last line of the first paragraph, Vizavin mina bitlesar istiri pshite bisra. Having declared it kosher, and I believe this refers to Rabbi Bar Bar Chana, Having declared it kosher, he then bought the meat. Okay, this is a little bit more challenging. Having declared it kosher, he then bought the meat. So, how do you react to rabbis being presented with a questionable halachic issue, and their response is, it's kosher, and they buy the meat?
It's inside a tree frame.
Okay, yes, Dave.
You could view it cynically, or they're saying it's kosher enough for me, showing everybody that it's okay to rely on.
So that's the problem. What's the cynical one? Conflict of interest. Okay, so that's a real challenge, right? Does it, right? Because on the one hand, right, you might say, wow, I don't really, right, you know, I don't like going into caterers where the mashgiach won't eat the food. Right? On the other hand, right. On the other hand, there's always a risk, right? If you eat the food, maybe the person will start giving you more of it, or more cheaply, because you actually did. I'll say I have a certain sympathy for the first position, because the first time I was really asked a kashrus shaila by somebody I thought was frumer than I was, so I was very nervous about telling them something was kosher. So I actually went out and bought the product, and drank it myself first, and then I called them back and told them it was mutter. But I wasn't confident in myself that I really meant it. until I was willing, right, until I went out and drank it myself, because you know when I was actually. So we'll talk about it. It's actually something that relied on a clever argument as opposed to just reading a book. Okay, so the Gemara is going to ask a series of challenges as to how Rabbi Bar Bar Chana could do this. So the first question the Gemara says, "V'heichi Yavid Hachi, how could he do this?" V'atanya Chacham Shetimei in Chaveru Rashai LaTaher Asar in Chaveru Rashai LaHatir. If a sage has declared something Tamei, then his friend is not allowed to declare it Taher. Tahor, if he declares it Asur, he's not allowed to declare it Mutar. There's a whole debate about whether that applies in reverse or not. But in this case, so his friend declared it Treif, right? Rav declared it Treif. How can Rav Bar Chana declare it kosher? So the Gemara said, no, Rav didn't really declare it Treif. He started investigating in a way which would make it Treif, but they caught him in time.
Wait, he did or didn't say it was Treif?
He didn't. They caught him in time. He was going to use a method that was inevitably going to, right? He was going to use method A, which was going to declare it Treif, but a student said, wrong method. So now, the interesting question, we could have all sorts of, and I haven't done the research, all sorts of issues about whether Rav would have declared it treif, but then he realized that somebody else would declare it kosher. So he sent it to somebody else to declare it kosher. Right? Why wouldn't he change his own mind? Did he not know this method? Those are all sorts of fun questions which are worth talking about in a, I guess, you know, what I call an ethics of poskim. Right? So one of the interesting questions are, what are you supposed to do as a posek if your answer to a question is not the best answer for the interests of the person asking it? Right, that's a really interesting challenge, right? I know this is right. If you ask me this question, I know the answer will be this. But if you ask me, do I think the consequences of my giving this answer will be great? No. And I know that Rabbi so and so will give you a better answer. So there's some cases, right? Yesterday.
Can you give an example of that?
Yeah. So I'll give you. There's the easy answer, right? You know, as far as I'm concerned, you're married, but so and so will, right? And you're naguna and you're stuck for life. But Rabbi so and so will declare, right? Will declare that your marriage was invalid. So go to Rabbi so-and-so, right? If that's one case, that's pretty easy. As long as you think Rabbi so-and-so is reasonable, right? We have to figure out what their standards are. Another case is just, let's say, you should talk about whether you inherit your grandmother's dishes. Right? Your grandmother wasn't from, her dishes are treif, but they're really beautiful, right? You grew up with them, you have a deep attachment to them. They come and ask me, right, Rabbi, can I just use, they've sat unused for the past year, or can I just do it? So my answer generally is I'm not convinced by the argument that you can. And therefore, I never answer that question. I'm telling you up front, don't ask me that question. If you ask me that question, I'll send you to somebody else. Why should somebody have to throw out their grandmother's dishes? Because I haven't been convinced by the argument. The OU says they are kosher. Right, Rav Moshe suggests that certainly in the case of Bali Tshuva, you can use it. So my own research, I wasn't convinced by the argument. So why should I mess up someone's dishes because you asked me that question? So that,
go with the morphine, the Titzelig, Rav Shlomo Zalman, Titzelezer.
Shlomo Zalman. Rabbi Willig once told us a story as follows, which I think is a great posek ethics question, which he told us when we were his shir, but he was recreating an earlier situation. He said a couple had come to him, and they had Rachmana Lislan. They had a their fetus had been diagnosed with Tay-Sachs.
What?
Tay-Sachs. And they asked him the question: are we allowed to abort or not? So Rabbi Willig looks at us and he said, you know, Tay-Sachs abortions, Rav Moshe says it's usher. That Tzitz Eliezer says is mutter. Who am I to decide between Rav Moshe and the Tzitz Eliezer? So I sent him to the Tzitz Eliezer. Right, that's a whole question about whether that is a good way to pass or not. Okay, but we got out of the first one. Then the Gemara says the second issue, which is much more challenging, right? Since this was an issue which already became the subject, right, required a halachic ruling, right? There really was judgment involved, right? Kevan de ori b'chacham. Since this is an issue, right, this is a piece of meat about which a sage felt it was necessary to issue a halachic ruling. Heichi achal mina, how could he eat from it? And we quote a pasuk from Yecheskel, which Yecheskel says, v'loba b'fi basar pagul, sh'lachalti mibehema shehora b'chacham. Right, he praises himself, I never ate from an animal that required a sage to declare that it was kosher.
Now, is this a higher standard, or is that a demand of din on everybody, that no one is allowed to eat from
So it seems to be a higher standard.
It seems to be a higher standard
to say, right? And there's a question about whether this applies to issues other than trefa. There's a question about whether if you're not on this level, you're even allowed to not eat because that declares disrespect to the rabbi. All sorts of fun challenges as to how you set this standard up. The Gemara's answer to this one is that only, right, that problem only applies to issues that require reasoning to reach the conclusion. But here, Rabbi Bar Bar Chana was simply relying on his tradition. His tradition was use method B, so it didn't actually require judgment on his part. Right, this right, all he was doing was reading a book, so it's not actually that issue. But it raises the question about whether that's sort of the direct contrast of the rabbi having to eat the food that he declares kosher. Right, there's a claim that once somebody felt compelled to declare it kosher, once the question came up, well then rabbis shouldn't eat it. We could compromise. Rabbis should only eat from meat that they themselves declared kosher, but not meat that anybody else declared kosher. But why should that be? It's a whole weird notion. But it raises the question of whether you want rabbis to have higher standards at all. Okay, then the Gemara gets to an issue. It says, "V'tepik le mishum chashada." Let's just say they shouldn't eat it because there's going to be a suspicion that it was a quid pro quo. That you koshered the meat because they were going to sell it to you. And we have a braita which says that after a judge has declared the judgment and declared somebody liable, somebody innocent, something tamei, something tahor, something forbidden, something permitted, or even if witnesses come to a court case, and they end up declaring that a certain thing is the halacha, and as a result they can now let's say that the thing is declared kosher, so everyone is allowed to buy, but the sages said, "Harchek min ha-ki'ur u'min ha-domelo." You should separate yourself from corruption and from the appearance of corruption. So how could Rabbi Bar Bar Chana buy the meat? Is he not thereby opening himself up to the appearance of corruption? So the Gemara says no, because the meat here was sold by weight. And if it's sold by weight, so everybody can see on the scale how much meat there is and how much he's paying. So there's no suspicion. And the other braita, which seems to suggest that you shouldn't buy things that you were involved with halachically, that braita is talking about a case where everything is sold on estimate, so there might be a suspicion that he might have sold it by estimate. So far, everything's pretty straightforward, the rules are pretty clear, and then we start getting into stories.
What is hacha?
Hacha is here.
Hacha
mitakla, from the weight. Mitakla muchach, right? From what it weighed is muchach. Okay, so now the Gemara says this distinction between buying meat that you declared kosher, which is sold by estimate, and buying meat that you declared kosher, which is sold by weight, that actually is that same distinction is found or emerges in a different story about Rabba. So we're in the paragraph that says kiha, kiha de Rabba shara tarfasa. So this is sort of like the story of Rabba. And Rabba permitted an animal, not an animal that was actually trefa, but an animal that was, that had a question been raised about this trefa, vizavan mine bisra, and he bought meat from it. Okay, so far we're exactly online. But now we have a new character in the story. So Amar le bat Rav Chista. So the daughter of Rav Chista, who happens to be Rabba's wife, says to him, when my father permitted a bechor, he would not eat the meat. Okay, now we need a lot of background information for this. Her father is a kohen. An animal that is a bechor is not useful unless it develops a blemish, in which case a kohen can use it. And not every blemish renders it fit for a kohen to use it. You're not allowed to cheat and create the blemish. So this created lots of opportunities for corruption, because particularly if you were a kohen and you owned an animal, right, or if someone brought an animal to a kohen, so there's lots of opportunities for corruption. Declare, okay, right now this animal is usable. It seems to be a test case. Right, there's a beautiful story in Bechoros, in which the lesser known story of Rabbi Gamliel and Rabbi Yeshua is when they're not arguing about whether Ma'ariv is Rashut or Chovah, they're arguing about whether we allow rabbis who are Kohanim to testify for themselves that an animal acquired its blemish accidentally. Because normally we don't allow Kohanim to testify, oh, it just happened. We require Kohanim to bring witnesses that it happened accidentally, as opposed to them putting it there on purpose. So Rabba's wife says to him, when my father permitted something. Nowadays, pardon?
Nowadays, I mean, then, back then it was only the Kohanim could eat it, right?
Yes.
It was out of blood. But today, it has to have blood.
No, even then, right, even, this is already after the Beit HaMikdash, we're talking the time of the, even, yeah.
So today.
Yes. So you have to bring it as a korban, right? No, right? I'm blanking. The korban is born as a korban unless it has a bloom, and then you can use it. It's the same kind of issue. So Rav Chisda's wife says to Rabba. Sorry, Rav Chisda's daughter, Rabba's wife, says to Rabba, "Right, what are you doing? How can you buy this meat that you declared kosher? My father would never do anything like that." Okay, and the response he gives is no, because you're talking, right, your father said this about a bechor, and a bechor is sold by estimate, and I'm saying this about a regular treif animal, which is sold by weight. The same answer, and so far we're exactly on the same line of the Gemara, where it seems like we have a pretty clear line. Rabbis should make sure that they don't in any way subject themselves to the appearance of impropriety, and the rules are, you know, pretty clear. And then all of a sudden, the story goes off the rails. So now Rabba turns to his wife, and you don't know what kind of domestic drama is going on here. And he says to her, "Well, you know what? I can see why you might think it's different. Or you might think this is not a convincing argument. Why would you might think it's not a convincing argument, even if it's sold by weight? You might think there's still an appearance of impropriety. Why? Because even if it's sold by weight, what's the other axis?
The best
quality.
Cut of meat.
Quality, right? We're selling all the meat of the animal by weight. So how do we know that we're not selling you a high quality cut at the standard price, right? So we say ma'ika, right? Ma'ika. What is there? What grounds are there for suspecting me? Rashi says ba'mei yicholin. Two lines from the bottom. Ba'mei yicholin l'chashdeni. What could they suspect me of? Mishum sheshokin lo halitra me'umsa malyasa. Right? They're gonna give me the best meat. So he says, no, don't worry about that. You know why? Because they always give me the best meat. So you don't have to worry that there's going to be any appearance of suspicion about my getting the best meat for this. So now what do you do with this story? Right, all of a sudden, up till now, everything's been really, really straightforward, and all of a sudden we just go completely off the rails. What do you do with that line?
Say that he's joking.
Say that he's joking. You could do that, right? He's just teasing his wife, right? She threatened to embarrass him in public, right? By you know, we could all domestic drama, right? He said, "You're not as good as my father." Ha! Well, I'm as good, right? I'm as good as your father. And by the way, that was a dumb question, right? I don't know. Paul, yes, Tova.
I don't have a good answer.
You don't have it, yes, Ellie.
I think maybe he's saying that perhaps being that he has a long-standing relationship with the community, He's able to do questionable behavior, like
that's
seeming
outworthy. That's bad, isn't it?
Yes.
Do you think that's a good idea? That as you get, the longer Rabbi serves, the more he can get away with.
I mean, I've seen it with my own eyes, like Rabbi becoming hamish with the community and doing like strange things to the outsider's perspective.
And that's good.
Maybe I'm cynical. I don't know.
You're cynical? No, I would say the reverse. You're being cynical, right? I would say you're being, you know, that I don't know. That's really risky.
Why? He's saying that I do this all the time.
Uh huh.
What does that mean? That means that I've done this all with my congregants.
Uh huh. And we don't get to hear what his wife says, but his wife may say, "What? Right? We've been yelling at you for the past 20 years, right? How? Right? You're telling me, right? He's doubling down, right? You're saying there's an appearance of impropriety for this thing," and she's saying, "What? You're taking special favors from the people who ask you kosher shaylos all the time."
It's not special favors if it's open in public and everyone knows about it.
It's not special favors if it's open in public and nobody knows about it.
No, and everyone knows about it.
Alan, what do you think?
Well, I'm still trying to understand this case. I understand the case of the Kohen that they're benefiting from something they otherwise might not benefit from, and no one else will either.
Right.
But in this case, one possibility is the rabbi thinks it's treif, is declaring it kosher anyway, which doesn't really make sense.
Why?
I mean, it's possible.
Because rabbis are not like other human beings, and they will not declare things kosher.
Right? If he's going to call it treif, and then, I mean, I was thinking earlier, maybe he's calling it kosher because he knows it's fake. He wants the guy to get some money, and he's going to buy it and throw it away. That may be an optimistic thing. But say he thinks it's treif, is he really going to buy it and eat it? And if he thinks it's really kosher, then once he declares it kosher, can't the butcher then, you know, on the market, sell it to anyone?
Yeah, but he wants
so one. What, in other words, why would he sell it to this rabbi?
Because it's a favor.
Less? But what favor is he doing if he can get more money on the market from someone else?
No, the butcher is selling the rabbi, right? The rabbi ordinarily... Right, ordinarily would only be able to buy the gristle and bone, right, which sells at the same price per weight apparently, and the rabbi is selling him I don't know whatever your favorite cut is for the same price. He's selling you right. He's selling rib steak for the price of flunkin or whatever. So that way, the rabbi is much more likely to declare the right not only to declare this animal kosher, the rabbi is much more likely to declare the next animal kosher, because he knows right. Whenever I declare an animal kosher, I get rib steak. Right. Last week I declared his animal treif, right? And right, and I never want to eat, you know, I would never want to see a flunkin like that again. Right? That's the I think that's a perfectly reason, you know, that's how we talked about regulatory capture. Right? So that's a very nice carrot and stick approach. Right? You know, and I think pretty clearly if you tell the rabbi every time you declare a kosher, right, you get a biscuit, and every time you don't declare a kosher you get electric shock. It's going to work pretty well. And rabbis like everyone else. Yes, Arlene?
We have to remember that they didn't have a supermarket then, the Yehud.
Uh-huh.
That was the cow, and if it's kosher, they didn't have any meat to eat, and if it's kosher, they did have meat to eat.
So the rabbi is a self-interest, period.
But
I think it's also, I think we have to recognize how much economic pressure there was on rabbis to declare cows kosher. Because a cow is an awesome amount of money. And you shecht a cow, right? It's basically everyone's, right? So I think that there's economic pressure generally. The question is, to what extent is this always artificial? Because if the rabbi declares too many cows treif, they're going to fire him. Right? They're going to stop bringing shilas to him. So it's not clear, right? So the question is, and maybe we're dealing with a case where the rabbi is not professional. Right? There is no official position of rabbi. They're just figuring out who they bring questions to. And you know what? Then we have the reverse question, right? The rabbi is using his time. Isn't he supposed to get something out of it? Right? It takes a lot of time to write. Blow up the lungs, right? Check it out. It's specialized work. It takes extra work. It's not really fair to have the rabbi spend every night at home blowing up lungs. Right? So that's the reverse. Yaakov, what do you want to say?
How are you reading the... couldn't you read the fact that Baruch doesn't respond in three ways either? Or three ways, I guess. Either she doesn't respond because the Gemara just doesn't know her response, or she doesn't respond because she agrees with him, or
yeah.
She doesn't respond because he realizes the ridiculousness of what...
We could read it whichever way we want. So we don't know what happens next.
Couldn't we read this as an ethical statement, that Rabbah realizes what he's saying is ridiculous and learns from it?
We could, okay. But it's going to get cooler. Don't worry. Okay. It's going to get cooler. This is just the setup. Yes.
You seem to be reading that when he says, that's what I do all the time, they always give me the best part.
Yeah.
You seem to be reading that as if he was saying that whenever they come to me with the shayla,
no.
And I buy...
Whenever I buy meat.
Whenever I go and buy meat. Okay, so whenever he goes and buy meat, so what's wrong with that? I mean, so then the question is, when he goes, then presumably they give him the best and so on, because...
Good, so that's exactly the question. That's exactly, as we have nowadays, right? So we have all sorts of rules now about what sorts of gifts presidents, judges, congressmen can take, right, from people who are trying to respect their position, because we think that there's just too much possibility of corruption if we allow gifts. So do we really?
And it's not an issue of that they gave him steak at the price of flunkin, because in those days they didn't have that distinction. That they just bought by weight, otherwise,
but
that when he gave the steak, he gave him good steak rather than.
Everyone, you know, probably still nowadays, you can read any story of times when people bought meat at the butcher as opposed to at the supermarket, and the butcher would have their favorite customer to whom they would throw in things. And they're not so favorite customer. They would not throw in things.
Right.
Right? So the rabbi was the favorite customer. So the issue is this really, is this, now this is, you know, is problematic in terms of contemporary conflict of interest laws. And you have to worry, right? So if there are two butchers in town, and one butcher gives the rabbi the best cut, and one butcher gives the rabbi the not-so-best cut, so is the rabbi going to end up asking differently if the butcher gives the best cut, and the butcher gives the not-best cut? So that's a whole, right, question about how you... You know, Bat Rav Chisda seems to be setting up the standard which she's claiming the name of her father, and we'll see in a moment whether that holds up, that you really have to avoid any appearance of impropriety. And Rav Chisda is saying that that is creating an impossible... I think Rav Chisda might be saying it's creating an impossible standard.
Rabba is saying.
It
should be Rabba, I think. Isn't Rabba married to Rav
Chisda?
Is it
a typo?
I believe so.
Yeah.
Could be.
Not on your part. I think
yeah, it could be. Okay. So I think that's... He doesn't say, he just responds.
That he's within the standard.
That's right, he thinks that... Right, but I think he's saying that, you know, I think that you'll see at the end of the story why I think this, we have to wait till the end of the page, but I think this is on purpose, and I think this is a literary device, where he gives the same answer, we expect this answer to stand in, and then all of a sudden he doubles down on her claim. Right? So I think that is on purpose, and that he's throwing it back at her. Yes. I don't know whether maybe he was just a local rav. I really don't know the answer to that. Okay, next page. Okay, now you can have pages 2 and 3 together because 3 is commentaries on 2 if you want. So
what is page 2?
Page 2 begins Amar Rav Chisda on top. So after we have the story about Rav Chisda's daughter challenging her husband, so now we have a statement of Rav Chisda. And the statement of Rav Chisda is as follows. Ezehu Talmid Chacham. Who is a Talmid Chacham? Zeh haro'eh treifa la'atzmo. This is one who sees a treifa for himself. Okay, what does that mean? So first of all, what does it mean, who is a Talmid Chacham? So we have two categories. We have a Talmid Chacham and a non-Talmid Chacham. And normally the answer is a Talmid Chacham is somebody who knows stuff, and a non-Talmid Chacham is somebody who doesn't know stuff. Right? So Rav Chisda is playing with your expectations, right? Whenever you have a statement, Ezehu. Right, Ezehu Ashir, right, who's wealthy, somebody who's satisfied with their lot. Right, so this is a genre that you're designed to subvert expectations. So the question is, in what way are we subverting the expectation that being a Talmid Chacham depends on knowledge? Yes, Mitch.
Well, I think the way of saying it is that he's beyond, you know, suspicion. Right, he's a Talmid Chacham because he's on such a high level, nobody would suspect that he.
So a true Talmid Chacham is somebody who can, this is like Eliezer's position, and somebody who can engage in activities that appear to be self-serving, but nobody will suspect him otherwise. Right? So a re'et treifa la'atzmo means somebody who paskins an issue which other people might rule as a treifa, but he says it's not a treifa, and he gets away with it.
No, I answered that.
Isn't that what you said?
No.
Well, let's try it again. Right. Which way? Because he never does anything suspicious, or because you would never suspect him no matter what he does?
He's on the level such that you would never suspect him of doing something improper.
So we're back to Ellie. No matter what he does, you won't suspect him. Even if he engages in activities that other people would seem self-serving, but he's the rabbi. He would never do anything like that. Okay, that might be, right? That's the mark of a true Talmid Chacham is that he is above suspicion. Even if he does things that are suspicious. Right?
What does it mean here? Is he calling it a treifa or is he not calling it a treifa?
Ah, so that is the whole issue. What does a roeh treifa mean?
No, the atzmo. What does the atzmo mean? For his benefit? Or...
Okay, good. So we have our first two possible meanings. One is somebody who sees an animal which you might think is a treifa about himself and declares it not a treifa and gets away with it. That's a true Talmid Chacham. The second possibility is, right, a simple reading, is it's somebody who sees his own animal, declares it a treifa, even though somebody else might think it wasn't the treifa, and that thereby demonstrates his integrity.
Okay.
Right. So the second possibility is the true Talmid Chacham is somebody who sees his own animal and declares it a treifa, even though he's aware that somebody else might declare it kosher. And so both of these possibilities show up in Rishonim, either he decides the Chumrah for himself to avoid this appearance of impropriety, or he even goes so far as to refuse to send the question to somebody else who's Mekel, Right? He's always mafmir, right? So we have two diametrically opposed readings. Right, so he's showing how he has such integrity that he is willing to suffer the financial loss of having his animal be a treifa, and even declare that his animal is a treifa. Right, so that's the real. So that way, the real Talmid Chacham is somebody who shows such integrity that you really appreciate him as an ethical being, and the other is somebody who has already shown such integrity that he can do whatever he wants. Yes.
That sounds like the opposite of Talmid Chacham, to be machmir, like. Ruin your own animal, even if you have a clever way of.
So it's right. So that's why it's subversive. You might think a Talmid Chacham is somebody who is clever enough to always declare his animal right kosher. No, Talmid Chacham is somebody who suspends his own cleverness when it comes. Right. So that's right. This is all the, and now this is all based on my bias that I like to read statements as subversive. Right. It might just be a straightforward statement. Who is a Talmid Chacham? These are all the Mishonim. Talmid Chacham is somebody. Right, who is so good that they're capable of declaring their own animals kosher?
Why can't it just be someone who's able to judge whether an animal is treifa or not?
Then why do we need Latzmo?
By himself.
By himself, not bi'atzmo, but by himself.
But
yes.
It says particularly,
yeah.
Kishnolad
sacher. That's Rashi. That's Rashi. Right, you got to look at right, but I have a whole bunch of interpretations. Rashi reads it. Right.
Kishnolad sacher.
Yeah. Rashi reads it straight. Rashi reads it that he's machmir about himself.
He's machmir.
Yeah.
Which means that he has suffered, but if he feels clear that it's kosher, he should rule it kosher.
Of course, if he feels.
Even if there is some kind of a tam with somebody.
That's right. If it's perfectly clear, there's no question, then every animal already, he doesn't have to trafe every animal. It's only an animal that raises this only comes up once somebody looks at that and says, I don't know about that lung. Right. Yes.
Is there a third possibility where latzmo means that it's metir, where the letter of the law is met, but he restricts himself? The latzmo being that applies to the machmir. The machmir is as to his own consumption, as to his own.
Aha.
Even though it answers to the requirements and he has. And he decides to make here, there is some other something that doesn't fall into the.
Right, so the true Talmid Chacham is somebody who is machmir for himself and make kill for others,
yes.
Which gets the mashkiach who doesn't eat the food.
But all of this is in the gathered of higher standards.
Yes, probably. Well, I don't know.
An ordinary person like myself. If I know that one rabbi would be matir and one would be osir, I'm going
to. Could be that you're okay with that. Yes?
He doesn't have to meet higher standards. He just wants to remove himself of any impropriety.
Yeah. Could be. I should, but Tosfot points out, by the way, that this Ezot, which is a wild claim, Tosfot says Ezot Talmid Chacham has an antecedent. There's a Gemara also which says that normally, if you pick up an object on the street and it's an object that you have to return because it has some kind of siman on it, but and somebody comes up to you and says, right, so let's suppose I find this pen on the street, and I ask, right?
Right.
Pardon?
You can trust the Talmid Chacham, right?
So Talmid Chacham can just say, yeah, that was my pen. I don't remember what was written on it. But this is sort of like my pen. So Talmid Chacham, Surve Mirabanan. You can trust, Betzvius Eina. Right? Even if he doesn't give you a siman, he can look at it and say, yeah, that's sort of my pen. So now, so Tosfos claims that's what this means, right? It's not a question of scholarship. It's when we said over there that you can trust the Tzurva Merabanan to just claim lost objects, that means the kind of Tzurva Merabanan who is Roet Trefel Atzmo. So that ties in very nicely with the claim that this must be a mark of much higher ethical standards. And it doesn't define the status of Talmid Chacham generally by ethics as opposed to... Okay, what I'm going to point out is that each of these readings fits well with another part of the story and badly fits well with one part of the continuation and badly with another. Okay, so here we go. So Rav Chisda has another statement. Rav Chisda's statement says, Ezehu sonei matanos yichye. What is meant, right? Who fulfills the verse in Mishle? Somebody who hates gifts will live. Zehero etre fala atzmo. Okay, so now try and explain to me, based on one of these definitions. Right. How does ro'et treifah la'atzmo, however you defined it last time, how does that become the epitome of somebody who hates gifts will live? All right, Elliot, try it.
So for Rashi's reading,
yeah,
I think it's pretty easy.
Really? Yeah.
So either that what could be free, good meat for you,
mm-hmm.
you are machmion, therefore don't eat it, and therefore you hate gifts because you're not taking what could be kosher. You're saying no, that's treif.
So net matanos yichya means people who don't eat treif when they could.
You're hating the gift of you being able to make it.
So it's true, right? Rashi, by the way, this is probably better than I think than what Rashi actually says. Right? Rashi says somebody who wouldn't declare an animal kosher when he could, to his own loss, would definitely not take bribes from other people. But the problem is. Okay, he doesn't say bribe, so that's not fair. Rashi says somebody who would not declare his own animal kosher when he had the opportunity would definitely hate taking gifts from other people. So that's all true, maybe, but the claim that that's the meaning of the verse, the meaning of the verse is somebody, right, is derived by Kal Vachomer? Yes?
I mean, this is creative and maybe even worse than the way you're proposing. Perhaps if he makes his own animal treif, it's good for business because people will respect him. And that's the way Yichya means, like, it's his livelihood.
Okay, what does Sonei Matanot mean, though? Gift?
His gift of being a Talmid Chacham and having power to choose.
He hates his gift of being a Talmid Chacham?
No, so much. Yeah.
I don't know. That's really pushing it. I think that's really, really pushing it. This is a very hard thing to read. Yes, Hish.
I would have read from the beginning. The reason, right, a Talmud Chacham who's road trip last one means he doesn't need to rely on someone else.
Uh-huh.
And that's why he's a Sonei Matanos, because he doesn't need to rely on someone else. He can rely on.
So the first one means somebody who rules in favor of his own, right? So a real Talmud Chacham is somebody who can declare things kosher on his own and not worry about people suspecting him. That goes back to Mitch's point. Why?
And not necessarily having people suspect him.
We have just completely lost the realm of Chashad. And it just so happens that this statement of Rav Chisda is quoted after the story of the daughter of Rav Chisda, because they're both about treifos.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, that's a weakness. Right, that's a weakness. It makes it sort of serendipitous as opposed to integrated. Yes, all right.
So I thought
So do you think that Rava or Rabba, whoever it was a Sonei Matanot?
Not from the previous story.
Pardon? Yeah, so that's all right. So now the question is, right, are we creating a consistent position? Or are these stories, right, playing off with each other? And now we could, you know, turn to whatever rabbinic students are in the room and say, so which character do you identify with? All right, Rabba with a clever retort, right, or this person. Or, right, now we've already found that Yesh is perfectly capable of reading this entirely differently. Right? So Matan Yichya, people who have to paskin for themselves, who can paskin for themselves, don't need gifts from other people, because after all their cows are kosher.
No.
Our cows. Like Wilbegon cows.
We have to read Rav Chisda in both cases. As regards Talmid Chacham, it's not a matter of a definition. It doesn't mean what's the definition or what does it mean to be a Talmid Chacham. It means Zehu or Trefal Atzmo. Or what does it mean to be Sonei Matanot Yichya? What he's saying here is that if you want to see a sharp characteristic of a Talmid Chacham, here is Zehu or Trefal Atzmo. Or do you want to see a sharp characteristic that you would expect from a Sonei Matanot Yichya that brings it forward? So it's not so. Of course, if you took it as a definition, it would mean that every Soleh Matanoshich is a Talmid Chacham, and every Talmid Chacham is a Soleh
Matanoshich.
Yeah, because.
Oh, because be if you. Oh, not all definitions mean. Right, all definitions mean that all, you know, this is the original fallacy, right? To say that all men are mortal is not the same as saying that all mortals are men.
No, but he's, so, but a definition does mean that.
No, all men are.
As opposed to all.
Okay, I don't think definition.
All,
I think, you know, I think paradigmatic case.
If you're reading it as all, or every Talmid Chacham, it's Roeh Treva Latzmo. That's fine. That's what he's trying to say. A person who's truly a Talmid Chacham, he would see Treva Latzmo. And a person who is truly a Sone Matanot, Yichye, that person would be one, all of those, are Roeh Treva Latzmo.
Okay, I don't think we're disagreeing. I really don't. I don't think we're disagreeing. But
so
let's
then what, if you read it that way, then what's the question?
So let's hold off because there are two more of Chistis we have to get to, and then we'll see. Yes, Alan.
I don't know if he's in a contradiction because Chistis' daughter already drew the contrast between her husband and her father.
Uh-huh.
And you can read this as a
we're just playing out the characters.
It's a rebuke of his son-in-law. He's saying, "You called it kosher, but you really don't have the chacham. You're accepting gifts, or you know."
So it could be just a consistent thing. She really is properly carrying on her family tradition, and her husband is not. Right, so we have two opposed positions. So there again, right now, is it just a halachic question? Who do we paskin like? Right, where how does that relate to an ethical curriculum? Yes, Jenna, what do you want to say?
I mean, just that I think they're pretty easy to put together. I feel like people have said this, but it just doesn't seem like a contradiction because by being able to call it kosher,
mm-hmm.
that's a gift. That's something. There's nothing wrong with it. I don't think there's anything wrong with a gift. Like, a normal person hands someone else a gift, that's great. That's a beautiful thing. There's nothing wrong inherently with taking a gift.
Right.
What differentiates the Talmid Chacham is that they're in a position where they have more power than other people, and it's more easily the lines are blurred. So just like with kosher and treif, like there's, okay, it could be kosher, and there's nothing wrong with calling it kosher, and for someone else in a case where it might be good for them, so why not call it kosher? But I understand that for myself, that like, there could be a temptation one place or the other to, like, maybe when I really do think it's treif to call it kosher. So anytime there's a dispute, I call it treif. And anytime I'm offered a gift, even if there is no impropriety, just in case I won't be able to tell next time that there is impropriety, I don't.
Okay, it doesn't satisfy me in that usually when you say Ezo, this pasuk, I want something that really illustrates this pasuk directly. And
I think Elliot said it, that, like, that is a gift to be able to make that decision.
I think it's pushing it. But I want to read the next one anyway. And let's see what happens. Okay. Rav Zitra, Mar Zitra taught in the name of Rav Chisda. Anybody who's korei v'shune, anybody who reads Tanakh and learns Rosh Bapeh, v'roet treifa la'atzmo, he does this same thing called roet treifa la'atzmo, v'shimesh talmidei chachamim, and he is also apprenticed with scholars, which... Plausibly, you have is somebody he has read Tanakh, has learned, has memorized the memorizable sections of Rosh Balpeh, and also learned judgment. And by the way, they're also read Treifa Latzmo in the middle of that. Right, so this is a weird statement, right? The Kara v'shana v'shimesh talmidei chachamim, that's a perfectly regular juxtaposition. Kara v'shana v'roeh Treifa Latzmo v'shimesh talmidei chachamim, that's a really weird one, especially why does roeh Treifa Latzmo show up before v'shimesh talmidei chachamim? Is that what you wanted to ask him now? Yeah, that's. I'm not going to have an answer to that one. So what is right? Alava Ketuva Mer, about him the pasuk says, Yegia Kapecha Kitochal Ashrecha V'Tovlach. When you eat the results of your own toil, then life is good. Razvid says, what do you mean by life is good? You benefit in the next world, and you benefit in this world.
I'm just curious to know if keeps him in line ethically.
I don't know. I don't know what it means. I don't know what Roeh Treifa Latzmo is doing in the middle there. All I have is now I have a claim. So now I have three things Roeh Treifa Latzmo has to fit. It has to be at least a paradigmatic case of Talmid Chacham. It has to be a paradigmatic case of Sonet Manatanos Yichye. And somehow it has to lead to getting it right, to really turning out well, even in this world and the next world.
It's having the cake and eating it too.
Yes, it's having your cake, eating it too. So how is that? What does Roeh Treifa Latzmo mean here?
This is great. He's helping us, right? Or is it just like
He's helping us?
We only have to say this? Okay, the only reason that we have to put Rav Trefa Latzmo, sorry, I'm like reading my English. The only reason we have to put Rav Trefa Latzmo in between, like the only reason the researcher must be coming to explain the difficulty that we must be having with the phrase Rav Trefa Latzmo, right?
Oh, that must be why he's doing it. Could be. I don't know.
Okay.
Perfectly reasonable.
Like,
yeah.
The reason that this is telling us that it's good, that this is good for Olam Hazeh and Olam Haba, because one of the stories ahead might have made us think that it was bad for Olam Hazeh. One of the stories ahead might have made us think it was bad for Olam Haba.
One of the stories might be Olam Hazeh because you lose the cow.
I don't know.
And one of the stories Olam Haba, why? Those are different meanings. Right.
One of the stories must have made us think.
Aha. Uh-huh.
So he's like giving us
scripture. Aha, uh-huh. That's nice. You have to find a way to tie it in. Yes, sir. Yeah. Yeah. No, it's not supports. It's you, right? It's you hang around Talmidei Chachamim so that you, right? And you, it literally means you serve them, but it means you're in an environment where you get to where you shadow them and you get to observe them in practice.
Well,
I think.
It also means doing physical labor for them while you're shadowing them.
It's, yeah, the best way to frame it is Karate Kid. Right? You spend your time wax on, wax off, or whatever the, or, but I can't get, the new one just doesn't work as well. Code on, right? Wax on, wax off. And, right, that's what Shemesh, nowadays we don't do that so much, but Shemesh Talmidei Chachamim means, you sit in your teacher's office, right, while people are asking Shailot, and you watch, then you get to ask your teacher, why did you decide that way? Why did you decide that way? Right, it's a relationship that extends beyond the academic. You have a practical. I think. Right, yes, Judy, what do you want to say?
I'm not just going to add anything, but I don't know why Baruch Trefa Latzmo is like in the middle as opposed to the end, but like if it had said Kore Shona Vishkesh Hamidi Chachamim, so I would think that if someone is Ra'ui Lahora or maybe has some sort of chilek in Torah, for the fact that but specifically because the
pasuk
is that's something that seems to be of a higher level.
Yeah. Rashi tries. I think it's really, really hard to read Rashi into this. Right? Because Rashi says the whole point is you don't eat. Rashi's whole point of Roe Trefa Latzmo is you don't eat it.
That's it. You get Sfar and Muhammad because you learn that and how long is it.
Right, really, right. But so I think the best... The clearest reading, if you look on page 3, there's a third paragraph, it's called Arman HaLarif, and there's an ellipsis in the middle, and then there's a paragraph that begins, Yigia Kapecha Kitochal, and then it says underneath that, it says, V'acherim Pirshu. Other people explain it as follows. Ezo Talmid Chacham Zeho Roe Trefa Latzmo. Who is the Talmid Chacham? One who is Roe Trefa Latzmo. Kilomar, this means to say, Shehigia Lichlal Kach, he reached the level, Sheodeh Lefaresh Ezo Huksheira Ve'ezo Trefa. He knows which animals are kosher, which animals are treif. Uchidai lismoch al atzmo, and he's capable of relying on himself. They know tzarich lorat acherim. He doesn't need any rulings from others. Umishum hachi kamar, and therefore it says alav gatuv amar yegia kapecha kitochal. Right, you eat the fruits of your hands. Why? The labor that you put in Torah is now letting you eat the meat. And that's our ethical summary.
That's our ethical thing.
Yes. Right, so that's the problem, right? It's the best reading of the last section, right? It's the best. It's the one that fits the pasuk Yigia Chachbecha Kitochal, and as the Marsha points out, it's beautiful, right? You get your Olam Haba because you learned lots of Torah, and you get Olam Hazeh because you get beef, right? It fits the pasuk perfectly. There's almost no other reading, right? The moral of the story is learn enough Torah so that you can declare your animals kosher.
That's fine.
Yeah. But it's not like a very deeply ethical point anymore.
Well, and it's still
no,
saying,
it is, right?
Why is it ethical?
The point is that you're the only person who is fully capable of something is judging someone who can judge on their own. Like, everyone should know enough halacha to exist in their own life.
Yes, that's not an ethical point, it's a religious point.
It might be an ethical point.
I don't know.
Okay.
I think everybody should learn enough, let's say, Hilchos Hasagas Gvul, so that whenever they want to drive someone out of business.
We're working on it.
Right? That's what we're doing. We're learning this summer because we want to be able to engage in ruthless competition. Right? We'll learn about Hilchot Ribit so we can figure out how to charge predatory interest, right, with the proper contract. There are all sorts of ways in which halacha is tremendously helpful for ethical development.
May start a rival co-op next year.
Ah, that's the risk. The risk when you teach students this. Okay. Yes, Arlene. Is it easier to declare something treif than kosher? It's easier to declare something treif and get away with it than kosher from a, you know, on a certain level. I think that's what we're saying, that it takes a certain stature to carry off it. Now, you might say that's not always true because people protest if you declare other people's stuff. But declare your own animal kosher, that takes more stature. If you don't know enough Torah, you're always at the risk of having to ask somebody else, and somebody else may either also may just be a machmir. Right? So you're stuck. So you should know enough Torah that you don't have to worry about being stuck with the crazy right-wing tendencies of the local rabbinate. All right, yes, yes.
So you run into the same problems. I'm saying Marsha says the same thing as me.
Yes. Yeah, right. Yeah. I didn't say that you weren't stating a good traditional position.
No, but then the two stories don't fit together.
Yes.
Okay.
This is a problem, right? There isn't a good way of reading all three statements of Retro Falatzmo together. Right? Because the first statement sounds really like it should be a, right, good for you, don't eat the meat, right? Right? Declare it treif for yourself. And the last story is obvious, you get to eat the meat, because it says you get, and the middle story about Sonei Matzor has nothing to do with anything, right? Because there are no gifts being involved. So I don't have a really good way of putting three together. Yes, Alan, then Jenna.
Maybe this isn't about much about treif at all.
Uh-huh.
Maybe we should read it, you know, more generally, like Haroeh Latzmos, someone who looks inside is able to see the treifa, you know, the ways that, you know, he might be corrupt or she might be corruptible, or, you know, maybe it's making a bigger ethical precept than we were even thinking. It's not about this one exchange.
So I need to be convinced that this story is supposed to be, I remember like one of Eitan Bluestein, the student at Ganrod, gave this beautiful allegorical interpretation of the first parak of Basra, which is about laws of laws of condo associations. And it's really beautiful, and I don't want to discourage it. I just don't. You have to convince me. You have to convince me. It was, you know, I think that's a kisharon, so go ahead. Right? But literally, I'm just not convinced. But if you find me one clue, right? I would say, if you can show that Sonei Matanot Yechieh fits with a Roi Treif Alatzmo, if you understand it that way, right? Then you've made enormous progress. You've got something I can't explain. So that would be right. That would be the clue if you can get in there.
I mean, both it seems to me are, you know, ways of being self, not self-critical, self-doubting. I mean, enough.
It's going to take more work than 5 minutes to get.
Yeah,
so I don't know, right? You know, I'm going to need a lot of convincing, but it would be beautiful if you could convince me. I think that's the right way. Okay, I want to read the end of the story and then do a closing thing, and then as I hope the conversation will continue for a long time. So we're in the last paragraph on the page headed Amar Rav Chisda. So I guess I should say brief opening is that one of the, right, do you all know that Gemara didn't come with really with beginnings and ends of literary units, so you have to sort of make up where the beginning and end of a sugya is, and particularly if you're interested in integrating halacha and agadah, that's always a big challenge, right? If you want to claim their literary structures, right, so literary structures require there to be some kind of defined unit. And Gemara doesn't really have defined units. So I am biasing you by treating what we have done so far as a defined unit, and I'm going to make the assertion that the unit begins where we began it, and it's going to end here. And you'll see why that would be, right, why that might have an advantage. Okay. So here's the story. Rabbi Lazar, when they sent him gifts from the White House, he would say, "Nope, I don't take gifts from the White House." Right, that would create the appearance of political bias. Right, and I'm a religious functionary. Right, separation of church and political authority. We're all for that. And when they invited him to come eat at their house, he wouldn't go. He was a purist. Rabbi Zera, he said to him, Lo kaboy mar yichi, he said, don't I need to live? Uchsiv sonei matanot yichia. Okay, so here we have that line, sonei matanot yichia. What does that mean? When people offer you stuff, even if it looks like really innocent, I just want you to, right, I'm giving you a gift because I honor you, because I love you, I just want you to come eat dinner. He would say the appearance of impropriety is absolutely essential.
You're assuming the sonei matanot is about impropriety? Like that's your...
Or maybe he just hated gifts. Maybe he just hated gifts. You're really right. So why would you hate gifts? Because he was really a a profound believer that you right that it's corrupting to right. He didn't want to live in an entitlement society. He only wanted to get what he deserved. Okay, also possible. Right. So whether they sent him gifts or they invited him, he would say, "I need to live." And it says, "Sonei matanot yichya." Rabbi Zera, kimeshadri le lo shakil. When they sent Rabbi Zera gifts, he did not take them. When they invited him, he went. Amar, he said, "Ityakure hudem ityakure be." They're not honoring me; I'm honoring them by appearing at their table. So what's the right? So what's the big deal? What's the big deal? Now, of course, he could have said the same thing about taking gifts, right? Those of you who are halachically cross-referencing, so we know that when a highly respectable person takes a gift, that is treated as giving it's really a direct financial gift to the lower status party when a higher status party takes a gift. And what's the classic nafkamina? You can marry somebody, right? By accepting, right? A man can marry a woman by accepting a gift from her if he has a higher social status. Because he has given her a shavah, right? A pruta's worth by accepting the gift. Right? Let us suppose, right? We shall, right? To avoid any risk, right? We shall take party, right? We shall take Jack and Jill. Okay, and socially, Jack is here, and Jill is here. And so Jack can say, "I hereby marry you, Jill, by accepting this $100 bill from you." And then she gives the $100 bill, and guess what? They're married because Jack has just given Jill a gift. Because he has given Jill the incredible social prestige of being the kind of person from whom Jack will take a gift.
That's a thing.
Yeah.
I think one of the things that Shulchan Aruch there says that it's stopped by someone who's makbid on someone with Tosicha. That's how you define a mechubad person.
It has to be somebody who generally hates gifts, except for this one, because if they didn't generally hate gifts, then you might not take this as anywhere near as important, right? So that's how the way you get the reputation of being somebody who is valuable to accept gifts is by turning down all but the most valuable. Hold out for the Ferrari, right? I don't take Chrysler from anybody. So. My contention is that this story is bookends with the reply of Rava to Bat Rav Chista. Right? So these are both, they both end with, you know, somebody looks like it's the appearance of impropriety, and the response is, no, this is just what's coming to me. Right? You concede the point, right? There is a certain level at which, right, I wouldn't take the meat cheaper. Right? I wouldn't do that. I wouldn't take the gift they send me. But there is an assertion on the reverse that it's just not plausible or not correct to have people live as if their position isn't real. Okay, so now what are we, right? So I think one thing we've shown is that a pure text curriculum doesn't really help teach ethics so much, because we can see that we have totally opposite readings of what this is. It's supposed to teach us that we're supposed to learn Torah so that we don't have to depend on people so we can avoid losing. Right, everyone else is stuck with the rabbi who's machmir, but we can paskin for ourselves. That's one. Or whether the risk is we should always be machmir for ourselves and be makil for other people. Right, so totally different, totally inverted conceptions of what the rabbinic relationship to halacha is. But for me, I think the point I want to emerge, or the point I would want to raise as a thought question, if I were actually using this in a course, is: so do we really want a world where people are never allowed to show appreciation to rabbis? Right, where rabbis have to live by these conflict of interest standards. Do they work anywhere? Right, really on a broad level? Or do they end up being evaded everywhere and you end up having to lie about it? Right, or is it as a natural, right? And how are people supposed to show Kvodot Torah? After all these things, right? Standing up when you walk into a room, right? So that can count as interest. Right, if it's ribbit, so all these things are gifts that people are giving you. People can be seduced by honor as much as by money. Right, so is there really, right, and part of the job of, in some way, however you define the job, if your job is however the community constructs the position to be in some way a symbol of Torah in the community, so there are always going to be things that you have to do, because the symbol has to be venerated, and then there's always going to be the risk of perverting that symbol for yourself. So I'll go back to the way in which I struggled with that story the story I told originally of the teacher in camp. So when I first came to Maimonides, and so I noticed on Rosh Chodesh they used to give the Talmud teachers the aliyahs, and all the students would stand up, I thought spontaneously. I may have been a little naive about that. but I didn't see the gestures. So it seems that all the students pretty much, they had learned it. Right? Nobody said stand up, right? Stand up, boys and girls. When the teachers got aliyot, all the students stood up, and I thought that was really beautiful. A spontaneous display of Kvod HaTorah. And I said to myself, wow, that plays into all my worst Yetzer Hara, to have a whole room standing up. When I walk in, that's going to feed. I am certainly susceptible. Susceptible to titles. I learned about that myself at a very young age, that I take titles way too seriously. And if you call me boss, so then I start trying to order people around. And I learned there are things that you... there are things hopefully you learn about yourself at some point, and then you try to overcome them. So that's one where I learned that in high school. I had a title-shifting thing with my, for the prime minister thing, where I would be prime minister, and he would be deputy prime minister, then he would be deputy prime minister, I would be prime minister. And really, it was just supposed to, I guess, so we could both use the title prime minister on our college applications. But I thought when I was prime minister, and you had to do what I said. It didn't work out so well. So I learned that I am susceptible to titles. So I got the honor, like, what do I do? Because on the one, I didn't want to say, first of all, to tell students, you can stand up for all the other teachers, rabbis, whatever you want, but not for me. So that's even more arrogant. All right, I'll out-humble those guys. All right, all of you should stand up for me, because I'm the one who doesn't want to stand up for, right? We can just play in ever games of escalating humility versus honor. And I thought it was absolutely the right thing. On the other hand, I just thought, wow, that would be really, really bad for my neshama. So what I tried to do was to make sure that I was, whenever they told me I would have an aliyah, and to some extent I still try to do this, although happily I am at less risk of people standing up for me now. but I tried to do was make sure I was always standing next to the bima when they gave me the aliyah, so nobody would have a chance. Because halacha is only supposed to stand up, right? If you think somebody's a talmid chacham, you're supposed to stand up while they're moving. Right? But if you're already there, so there's no, right, so there's no occasion at all. But that's I don't know.
I didn't know that halacha.
Yeah.
At least I didn't notice it that way. Like walking through a room where people are standing up is just, right, it just plays into all your worst impulses if you're susceptible to that kind of thing.
It is a huge power trip, though. Like, the whole room stands up for you.
It is.
But you need that, right? Isn't that part of the point?
So that's the challenge. How do you play it out, right? So at least when I was younger... right now, of course, I have overcome such small temptations. And so, Porsches, Ferraris, those kind of things. Even those don't tempt me, really, so you can try those. Those are fine.
Please, try my car.
You
can buy a new house.
Yes. Funny, right, if bribery be a curse, so God smite me down, right? But I think that really... is, and I think this goes back to the point that Trollope makes initially, is that we do expect whatever, again, the word rabbi is a bad word, I think, in many ways, because it means so many different things or doesn't mean things. We expect the people we build as communal representatives of Torah to be more than human in some ways, right? And we put them in positions where we have to treat them as more than human in some ways, because that's the way which we express Kvod HaTorah. Right, so you get the Rava statement, right? Silly Babylonians who stand up for Sefer Torah but don't stand up for scholars. Because right, obviously, living Sefer Torah more important than written Sefer Torah. On the other hand, expecting people to receive that kind of honor and not to think it's about them, as opposed to Torah, right? They're human beings, and like anyone else, it's going to go to their head. If you put people, if you say that because you're a rabbi, so that you are, right, so we believe that your unique insight into Torah gives you the opportunity to engage in deep personal counseling. And so you put yourself in positions, right, you put them in positions where they're constantly dealing with emotionally vulnerable people without supervision. So they're human beings. And it's not going to, they're not going to avoid. They're not going to avoid succumbing to the same temptations that everyone else will in the exact same circumstances. We have to figure out is what are the, to me, the questions are what are the things what are the positions in which rabbis of various types get put in, where they are placed in positions where, owing to their scholarship, title, job, whatever it is, they are put in the way of temptations that if the person weren't a rabbi at all, they would succumb to the same ones. And then they're just like everyone else. I think that the fallacy, as Trollope says it, is if you expect them to be more than men, you always end up teaching yourself to believe they're less. Rabbis who fall because they're allowed to engage in private counseling sessions with people without supervision, they're not better or worse than other people. They're in the same way. That's why we have Hilchot Yichud. Right? And so the danger point is, I think the danger part of it is having a communal check around whenever you find, I think, and here I am in contrast to the position that we sort of set up semi-satirically, whenever you find a religious figure saying they can do something that someone else can't because they have such a position, that to me is always a grave danger sign. And one of the way, and if I were teaching a self-check for rabbinic students, I would say, whenever you find yourself saying, I can do this because I'm a rabbi, you ask yourself, if I weren't a rabbi, would I be able to do this? And if the answer is no, then it's probably wrong. The problem is that that communities will constantly expect you to do things like that. If you ask me, do I think that most people can have room stand up for them and not end up being arrogant? The answer is no. I think most people, I think that being president of the United States must be a grave temptation to one's character. It must be very difficult to emerge from being president. Not arrogant. And those of you who watch West Wing, yeah, right? It's really hard, right? The president becomes the one who thinks that they can always win at basketball. That's part of the job. I have the conservative counter reading of West Wing. Which the president is not a hero. Yes? Pardon? What have I slain a sacred cow? Is it trefa?
You have to be far more convincing, I think.
About West Wing? Right, there's a whole series of this, right? We'll go through Dead Poets Society and West Wing and all the classic... Halachic Man, right? All the classic works, which I think have been have misunderstood, and which regrettably Leo Strauss didn't take care of in his persecution on the art of filming. But that's right. That's what I want to set out. I think that I think we need to acknowledge that there are positions in which people are put because they become communal representatives of Torah that subject them to temptations that anyone else would give into at some point. Not every person, but a certain percentage of people will fail when subjected to those temptations. And the challenge is what one has in every position. If you're a therapist, right, so you have to be constantly trained to be aware of the dangers of transference and countertransference and yichud and all sorts of things like that, and it doesn't work so well. Right, all of us, I don't know, those of us who would engage in it, know that there are lots of stories in which nonetheless therapists fall in love with their clients. All right, or abuse their clients and things like that. That happens. It's going to happen with rabbis too. We should be aware that as we set rabbis up as intensive counselors, then the best we can hope for is that they'll do as well as therapists. We talk about this on our Beit Din in terms of conversion candidates, right? So now we have numbers, happily, thanks to the RCA survey, and it was like something like 72% of Orthodox conversion candidates in the United States are women between the ages of 20 and 39. 100% of Orthodox conversion court judges are men between the ages of 20 and 80 or something like that, right? That's an interesting juxtaposition. And so we constantly point out in our Beit Din that you have to look at yourself and say, look, it's really interesting. You're really, really enthusiastic about this conversion candidate. Please make sure that your wife is as involved as conversion candidate as you are. Right? And people don't even know. People don't notice it happening to them. But every conversion court will know stories where that happens, where people get excessively involved, one or the other. So that, I think, again, that's the overlying theme I want to say is I don't think it's reasonable to expect even the best rabbinic school curriculum with the highest intellectual standards to produce human beings who are superhuman ethically. Probably they're not, and their human nature is not going to improve dramatically. It might be that halakha, to some degree, if done well, enables you to avoid some of the, right, some of the challenges that face everybody. Dr. Chaim Soloveitchik used to tell us that Yerodea was a manual about what happens after the car crashed. Kitchens, right, kitchen kashrut, the way people keep in their houses, are the ways to avoid crashing. So it might be, but parts of halakha, like ilchud yichud and things like that, are also ways to prevent the car from crashing. So it might be, if you keep people with really strict halakhic boundaries, maybe they'll be able to avoid it. But at the end of the day, it's really, really not realistic to expect people, just because they have learned Torah for certain times, to not be subject to human nature. And the flaw, right, and we always have to be thinking about is, if I put an ordinary human being in the same position and subject them to the same temptations and recognize what the temptations are, whether the seductions are pride or sexuality or anything like that, right? So if I wouldn't expect an ordinary human being to succeed more than whatever percentage of failure you think is viable, then don't expect your rabbi to either. And the goal is for rabbis, you know, and then create circumstances, create oversight, create all those sorts of things. And then we as a community need to figure out how do we square that with the notion that we want our rabbis to be superhuman. So we want to be able to say, you know what, if the rabbi says it, it's fine. Right? If the rabbi says it's kosher, I think that mostly we have to give that up. And rabbis should lead the way in giving it up and saying, you know, that I can't, right, if you can't go into the kitchen, right, without anyone knowing what you're bringing in, then I can't go into the kitchen without people knowing what I'm bringing in either, except insofar as there is iterative supervision. And rabbis have to be more careful about yichud than anybody else in terms of sexuality. And rabbis should make sure that they don't count the tzedakah money alone, right, just like everybody else. And we should make sure that we don't put them in temptation. We don't put rabbis into situations of temptation that ordinary human beings couldn't pass either. Okay, it's very late. People want to come and talk. That's great. But thank you thank you to Young Israel for hosting the program for the summer. Thank you all. It's always
a joy to teach people to learn and willing to learn and talk to Torah so seriously, especially when sometimes it runs late into the night. So thank you very, very much as always. I look forward to more.